You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 30th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everybody this week?
Tired, but all right. Mid-tax craziness.
Yeah.
Yeah, Evan, you're still slogging through taxes, huh?
14-hour days every day. Love it. Kill me now.
I don't envy you. Tax season's bad enough for the people like who you have to pay your own taxes too. It's not like you're exempt from that.
It's like this. Everyone kind of hates doing their taxes. It's a big pain. Imagine doing it 500 times in the span of about 10 weeks. That's kind of what I'm going through right now.
I can't believe my taxes are already done and it's not even the end of March.
April yet.
Thank you to that guy in Asia who hacked my social security number. Motivated me to finish it.
Thank you, Asian guy.
Do it.
Yeah, thank you.
There's a new ransomware going around. You guys hear about this?
No.
Oh, no.
And they're targeting hospitals.
Yeah, I heard about it.
Because ransomware?
The new ransomware can target a network. It can lock down an entire network, not just a single computer.
Whoa. Is that where it encrypts everything and you have to pay to get it unencrypted?
Yeah. That's right.
Yep. Nasty.
And then they're like slowly dialing up how much they're making you pay just to see how much people will pay to have their data back.
And they will pay.
Total scumbags.
How do you not?
I've heard of police departments being hacked and police departments paying to get their data back.
Oh, man, that would be terrible.
Back up. Just back up all the time. Screw them.
But it's got to be once you back up, then you got to like unconnect it because it will find your backup on your network. It does that too, so that you can't just restore from a backup.
Even in the cloud,
it could if it infects one of your files. Absolutely, why not?
Oh God! Jeez.
Yeah, because then the infected files get backed up.
I back up onto a hard drive, but if my hard drive's infected, then what do you do?
Well, you have to have good internet etiquette. This is the real way to prevent yourself from getting. Things like this are, the typical laundry list of do's and don'ts. You know, don't open up executable files. Mostly, I would say just try never to do that, but sometimes you have to. But you have to run a virus scan on them beforehand. You have to, only allow from trusted sites.
Yeah, just don't click files unless you are 100% sure you know what it is. Mm-hmm. I get phishing scams almost every day. I mean, I've been getting one that's like, oh, you have to pay your invoice. Please click here to pay your invoice. I'm like, oh.
Uh-huh.
But they make a mistake where I get the same thing from three different people, like within an hour.
Yeah.
So it becomes obvious that it's a phishing scam, but you got to be very, very careful. Just don't click anything.
I'm so depressed.
And that's the show, folks.
It's funny. We're at war on the internet, security war, and it's crazy. Our Society for Science-Based Medicine just got hacked.
Wow.
Oh, no.
Had to restore everything from a backup. It's a part of living on the internet now. You just got to have massive security.
I wish there were a better way to catch these people who are doing these things. It seems like you're helpless.
Yeah, I think it does seem like the FBI or whatever the appropriate organization is needs to really dedicate a lot more resources to this and have like a dedicated division or whatever. And they probably do. I don't know about it, but I mean, they just need to.
I think they do. I think they do, like, cyber crimes. Yeah. But they're probably, again, because of this, like, Patriot Act era we live in, I think they're so focused on, like, terroristic threats. And they're probably not as focused on this, which actually is domestic terrorism.
Yeah, it is. And this is, like, affects real people. And devastatingly, they really need to get on the ball and get one step ahead of these criminals. But it's always seems like they're one step behind.
They have to work within the rules of the bureaucracy as well, which slows things down. And a criminal is not subject to any kinds of rules like that. They can adapt much faster than the government can.
Yeah. That is true.
Okay, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week, I'm covering Dorothy Hodgkin, 1910 to 1994. She was a biochemist who won a Nobel Prize in chemistry and even had a Google Doodle of her very own in 2014. Hodgkin was born in Cairo to two archaeologists. How cool is that? I can't help but imagine her mom and dad as Indiana Jones and Marion Ravenwood. She went to school in England and studied chemistry, where she was one of only two women allowed to do that. She focused on X-ray crystallography, which uses scattered X-rays to determine the structures of many different types of molecules. We've talked about it on the show before. She was the first to image cholesterol penicillin and vitamin B12, for which she won the Nobel in 1964. And then in 69, she finally figured out what insulin looked like after 30 years of effort. 30 years to finally crack that thing, and an amazing effort. So she was not only a trailblazer, she was considered by many to have transformed crystallography from an art into a science.
And let me say that that's important, because knowing what a molecule like that looks like helps chemists to synthesize it. So it has a very practical application. It's not just, you know, basic
pretty
science,
pictures,
yeah,
right?
Knowing what it looks like, yeah.
Right. She was so respected that that Watson and Crick invited her to see the structure of DNA, which of course was created through crystallography, before it was even announced to the world. So they respected her so much. They said, "Hey, we haven't announced this yet. Come take a look at this." So very that must have been quite an honor. So remember Dorothy Hodgkin. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing NMR spectroscopy and tertiary protein structures.
All right, Kara, you and I are going to do a back-to-back neurological and visual system news items today.
On purpose?
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
Just checking.
Accidentally on purpose?
Accidentally on
can't
purpose.
I can't wait for the segue.
But why don't you go ahead and start with yours?
Sure. And it's funny, as you mentioned that, I am gazing deeply into the pinna illusion, which is this really awesome optical illusion where there are these different concentric rings, and they're made up of little rhombi. Yes, that is the plural of rhombus. And they're facing in opposite directions. So when you move at all, they look like they're moving, like pretty heavily. It looks like a motion graphic when it's actually a still image. Mm-hmm. You know, this was developed in the 90s, but today it was used to try to better understand the neurological basis of that phenomenon. We know a lot about sensation and perception in neuroscience. We know a lot about certain types of optical illusions, visual illusions, how we perceive them. But what we don't really understand is why we perceive them oftentimes the way that we do, and what's actually happening in our brain as we're processing that information. So in order to answer that question, researchers at the Shanghai Institutes for Biological Sciences decided that they wanted to look at the pinna illusion and use some high-tech toys to do so. So they were able to use fMRI studies and show people this pinna illusion and try to see what was actually happening in their brain. And just as a little bit of background, when we think about the vision system, we have to remember that it's made up of a lot of different components, right? You've got an eyeball, you've got the retina of your eye, and that's where all of those neurons that actually receive information from light or photons, that's where they're active. A lot of times we call this actual central nervous system, even though it's in your eyes, it's actually not the periphery. That portion of your retina feeds back. Some of those fibers cross across the optic chiasm. Some of them stay on the same side. They go across the lateral geniculate nucleus, and eventually they make it their way to the cortex, which is actually weirdly at the back of your brain, the occipital lobe, you know, four lobes of the brain, occipital's in the back. Everyone kind of get that eyeball to back of the brain? Feel good about that? Okay, good.
Yeah.
So obviously different visual phenomena arise at different places in that system. Some things are happening at the level of your eyes. Some things are happening along the fiber. Some things are happening earlier in the cortical process. Some things are happening later in the cortical process. And this is, I think, beautifully shown by cortical blindness. You guys know about cortical blindness?
Mm-hmm. Heard of it?
Yes.
Have you been watching Daredevil on Netflix? Anyone?
The latest season?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm familiar
not
with the
not the latest season, just the first one.
Gotcha. But there, it seems like, and I don't know his story, I just know that my boyfriend watches it, but it seems like he would almost be an example of somebody with cortical blindness. I don't really know where his blindness was supposed to have come from, but he can dodge things and he can move off curbs and he can do all the things that a lot of times people with cortical blindness can do because their eyes can see, but their brains can't process what their eyes see. We have to remember that those are two different phenomena.
We have talked about that. Yeah.
Just for our listeners, Daredevil uses essentially echolocation.
It's all just hearing.
Yeah. It's like his visual cortex started processing the sound waves to create it. So he can see. He sees with echolocation.
Gotcha. So he has remapped his occipital lobe using auditory cues.
Because they'll go into sequences where you're sort of seeing what he's seeing, and it's this black and white funky. It's a good effect, but you could say.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So let's say Daredevil, though, went to your office, Steve, and he was like, it's super weird because I'm blind, but I seem to be totally good in a knife fight. You might think, huh, maybe he has cortical blindness.
Yeah, and that and the phenomenon you're talking about is blindsight. And there are studies that show that people can navigate obstacle courses even though they have no conscious perception, visual perception.
And that's a key word. There's conscious perception. Yeah. I think that really plays into what this Chinese study is about. So basically, they showed the pinna illusion, which I described, to different people. And they compared the pinna illusion to actual physical rotation. So this is the difference between something that's a 2D thing that's printed on paper that's not actually moving but looks like it's moving to something that's physically moving. And then they wanted to figure out where in the brain do we see differences in this processing and where in the brain do we see similarities in this processing. So I think this is a really good sentence that I'll pull out because it really summarizes it. And this comes from their press release. Among the early and intermediate visual areas, in the dorsal visual stream, the subarea medial superior temporal of the, by the way, human middle temporal complex, which I have never heard about until I read this press release. I love human middle. Okay. It was predominant. So basically what they're talking about, the MST is the medial superior temporal, was predominantly activated by the pinna figure compared to the middle temporal subarea. By contrast, no significant activations in earlier visual stages and the ventral stream were related to rotation. Thus, these results, as they say for the first time, because it is this lab writing the press release or their press officer, these results for the first time provide direct evidence demonstrating that illusory rotation is represented as if it were real rotary motion in the human medial superior temporal portion of the brain. So what this is saying is that based on this level, you don't know the difference. And it's not just that you don't know the difference perceptually, but that your brain physically doesn't know the difference. That if I were to look at your films as you were watching both a moving image and an illusory image of movement, your brain is processing them the same way. Which is really interesting. Indistinguishable in these areas. And these areas are usually significantly implicated in rotational movement. The interesting thing about this study is that I first discovered it when I was looking through my feed readers because two independent outlets, both the South China Morning Post and the International Business Times, which I'm actually a big fan of, I read a lot of IBT, both reported on this study in the context of paranormal visions being caused by a communication breakdown between the brain and the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like a, wait, what?
And you'll notice that was mentioned nowhere in the study.
Exactly. It's not in the press release. It's not in the abstract. It's definitely not a top line situation. But one of the researchers is quoted in this IB Times story. And so I would assume that what happened, or I should say it's quite likely that what happened, is that a journalist in doing their reporting said, oh, could that be what describes why we see ghosts? Oh, yeah, that could totally be what describes why we see ghosts. And the funny thing is, it's actually not that far-fetched to think that way. It's just this often happens when we see science stories reported in the news, that the research is what it is, but these huge implications, these far-reaching kind of effects, like the one line in the discussion section – turns out to be the headline of the whole story.
Right. So you have the actual data.
Yeah.
And then you have some speculation in the discussion. And then the study becomes about the speculation and not the actual data.
And that's all I've seen online about this. Like nobody actually cares that it's actually really interesting that in this very specific portion of your visual pathway, it's not your eyeball, it's much farther in the system, that your brain is actually interpreting this data as if it's real motion. It doesn't know the difference. Like, that's fascinating. But maybe that also means that's why you see ghosts. I mean, I like the explanation. I'll give you that because I'm a skeptic. I think it's a better explanation than because there was a ghost.
I mean, it's
maybe I'll accept it's a part of the puzzle.
It's a part of the puzzle. But what I don't like is the standard way it keeps being reported. Quote, researchers find brain still has, quote, bugs, end quote, despite millions of years of evolution. As if evolution is supposed to be perfecting things in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. As if evolution was guided, as if evolution had any sort of purpose to it and wasn't totally random, which it is.
Right. Sorry, not despite evolution, but because of evolution.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a kludge. Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, this idea that the brain still has bugs. It still has, you know, we always use these like, oh, it's a hiccup in the brain. It's a mistake made by the brain. It's a brain bug. I just think really oversimplifies the issue.
Yeah.
It's a processing error. Is it really even an error or
a trade-off?
Exactly. Is it a trade-off? Should your brain be processing this way based on the information it's receiving?
Yeah. So that exactly dovetails with the story I'm going to talk about. It's also sort of framed around why we see a particular optical illusion. In this case, it's the triangle illusion. So you imagine three Pac-Men, you know, in the corners of a triangle, but that's all you have is the three Pac-Men, but your brain sees a triangle that's not there. You know what I mean? Including the connecting line, your brain connects the dots, as it were. And you really see a triangle. You see it, you know?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, so the question is, where is that taking place in the brain? But, you know, actually, when I read the study, that wasn't what the study was looking to answer because it was sort of taking that as a premise. We know that from previous research that higher level, hierarchically higher levels of visual processing communicates back to lower level areas. So if you think about it as, you know, like what Kara was saying, you have the primary visual cortex. The primary visual cortex just processes the raw data. It's actually not raw at that point even. It's already been processed in subcortical areas. But, you know, it takes the visual information that's already had a little bit of pre-processing on it, and then it assembles it, you know, into images. But then it goes to higher level visual association cortex, and that's the part of the cortex that gives it meaning, right? So you don't just have a collection of shapes, colors, and lines. You have a thing. You have, you know, a glove. It's not just the shape of a glove. It's a glove. And then it goes further, you know, to give it a high, even higher level of meaning. Like, does it have agency? Does it not have agency? And then what emotions are attached to it? You know, that's all, you know, hierarchically higher levels of visual processing. What this study was looking at was the connections between the primary visual cortex and the visual association cortex. And actually their primary question is, we know that the visual association cortex talks back to the primary visual cortex, so-called reciprocally connected networks. It's not just feeding information in one direction. It's feeding it from the primary cortex to the association cortex and then back to the primary visual cortex. What they wanted to know is, how does that keep from going out of control? You know, how does that, why isn't just these networks just firing all over the place? And what they found was that these networks talk to discrete areas of the visual cortex and they activate them without activating the entire visual cortex. So they're localized and not propagated. So that's very interesting to neuroscientists, not very headline worthy. So that they focused more on the background that the optical illusions are occurring in the brain. And that is the more interesting bit here. In the significant statement, the authors do talk about that as well. So what they found also in the study that the primary visual cortex neurons are that their response is facilitated about 20% by neuronal activity from the visual association cortex. What does that mean? This means that you see something, your primary visual cortex sends that basic information to your visual association cortex, which decides what it is you're looking at, which then sends information back to the primary cortex to make it fit even better, right? Mm-hmm. To connect the dots. So with the optical illusion, you send the image to the visual association cortex. The visual association cortex says it's a triangle and then sends information back to the primary cortex to connect the dots to fill in those lines so it looks more like, even more like a triangle.
It's kind of like how AI struggles if you – not AI. Well, yeah, basically AI, like computer vision, really struggles if they see the points of the ears and the tip of the tail and one eye to know that that's a cat hiding behind a tree. But we can see all of those things, synthesize them, and then I guess send it back to a lower level to reaffirm if that's what we saw.
Yeah, so it's – this could be an explanation for the experience you have when looking at certain optical illusions where the image snaps into place, mm-hmm. right? And then you can't unsee it, right?
Yeah.
It's like at first you're looking at a bunch of white and black blobs, and then you're seeing a Dalmatian, right? And then once you see the Dalmatian, it's so obvious. It pops, right? Why does it pop? Because once your visual association cortex decided that it was a Dalmatian, it sent information back to your primary visual cortex to make it pop, to make it look more clearly like a Dalmatian, to connect those dots. And you actually see them in your primary visual cortex. It's not just constructing the meaning out of it. It's also then back constructing the primary image to make it fit what your association cortex thinks it's seeing. Does that make sense?
So it could actually change reality in a sense, little bit.
Your construction of reality.
That's why it
pops. The simple, I think, assumption here is that the
tiger behind the leaves.
Yeah, the visual system has evolved to bring things into clear relief, into clear focus so that you can follow things. Yeah, to see the tiger running through the dappled light of a jungle and still be a tiger the whole time, and... So once your brain decides that's a tiger, it sort of reinforces that visual perception of a tiger so you could see it be all the better.
Yeah, like you have to recognize it once and then hopefully you can track it after that.
Clearly, the visual system is biased towards false positive, right?
Sure.
It's the man, the face in the moon.
Yeah. It's obviously, it seems evolutionarily advantageous to see things that aren't there as opposed to not seeing things that actually are there, right? Not seeing the tiger is probably more disadvantageous to your survival than thinking you see a tiger when, in fact, there wasn't one there. So our visual system seems to reflect that. Once you have some inkling that that might be a tiger, boom, you see a tiger. And it's visually reinforced at the fundamental primary cortical, visual cortical level. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a great, of course, skeptical teaching moment, because if you're motivated to see something, your brain will really try and help you out and make sure you see that, even though it's not really there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So like you see what you believe, right? It's like
believing is seeing. Yep. Great quote. Great quote.
More than or as much as seeing is believing.
Now, Steve, is this would this count for even like mundane things? Like I'm sitting at my desk. And anything that's in my vision could be under question?
Yeah, so absolutely. It's like the optical illusions are just constructed to bring it home, to like really accentuate these optical illusions, these optical processing effects. But they are there all the time in everyday little things. We take for granted that things are what they look like, but it really is a constructed illusion happening inside your brain. Things don't objectively look like anything. It's just how your brain processes the visual information to create an image. Color is all happening in your brain. The lines are being enhanced. Perspective and three-dimensionality is being inferred.
Qualia.
Think about when you look at something in different lighting conditions, that it has a permanence to it, even though if your brain was actually looking at that information independently, you would not be able to recognize the object if the lights were slightly dimmer. Because it's a totally different casting of shadows. It's a totally different color. But our brains can synthesize that and understand, that's the same thing. It's just 5% darker in here now.
So it adjusts everything. So
what drives
for
me
continuity
is the idea that everyone else isn't seeing the same colors I am. Like, blue to me isn't it probably isn't exactly the same color I'm seeing in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's like looking at different computer monitors, or like if you ever go to like the TV store where there's 100 TVs in front of you, it all looks slightly different, but it's blue is still blue, but it's not exactly the same blue from one to the next. That's probably what it's like.
Yeah.
Jay, tell us about the Tribeca Film Festival's recent woes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, you may have read about this. There's a lot to say, so I tried to condense it down to, I think, the most important thing that we learned from this whole experience. So this year's Tribeca Film Festival had a little intrigue. Robert De Niro, who is one of the people who organized the festival, and apparently is making a lot of the big decisions. You know, first of all, what happened is that De Niro himself approved a controversial film called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. And this is a it's a documentary that tries to convince its viewers that the Center for Disease Control, Evan, the CDC.
Like the one on The Walking Dead, season one?
The same exact company. the same exact government department, whatever.
It's a center.
But it is completely controlled by the U.S. government, Steve. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so the film claims that the CDC is covering up data that proves that there is a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. So the thing that makes this even worse is that, Andrew Wakefield himself produced the film.
And
if you don't know, Wakefield is a former doctor who faked data in his study. Oh, my God. I love that. He faked data in a study about a link between the vaccines and autism. And because of that study, which was published in The Lancet, he lost his license to practice medicine in the UK because the study was proven to be fraudulent. Like, he actually faked the data. The Lancet fully retracted his paper, and Wakefield later on become the face of the anti-vax movement and is now directly responsible for the deaths and horrible sicknesses caused by a decrease in vaccinations globally. This guy actually is responsible for people dying. So now back to the film festival. So De Niro happens to have an autistic child. Now, I really, feel sorry for him. I think we have a pretty intimate understanding of what it's like to be a parent that has to have an autistic child and, the drama.
So, Jay, let me say there's a spectrum, right?
Yep.
Many parents are delighted with their children who happen to have autism. It's not, you shouldn't stigmatize it or make it seem like it's always this horrible thing. And, parents are devastated. Some, children are fine. Parents are happy. They're lovely. You shouldn't stigmatize it. Seriously.
Yeah, I completely agree. But what I guess my point is that a lot of people that have autistic children really want to help their children. So they.
I get that. I know you meant well by saying that. But, the problem is then it overstates the situation and it turns it into an unnecessary stigma. So you do have to be a little bit sensitive to the fact that it's, it is a very broad spectrum and parents are not always unhappy with their child. Or it's not like this horrible thing that's happened to them, yep. So you just got to be careful with that.
But I would think I agree with you, Steve, but I would think, De Niro, because he stated, he has an autistic child in his family, that this is a sensitive topic for him. And he wasn't aware of the entire backstory of the anti-vax movement and all the details. And he thought the film would start a worthwhile conversation about the issue. So he said, My intent in screening this film was to provide an opportunity for conversation around an issue that is deeply personal to me and my family. So, I get that. And, I want to cut the guy some slack because of that. So there was a significant roar that came from the scientific community because of this. A lot of people were upset. I know I was personally very upset that the Tribeca Film Festival was going to screen that ridiculous documentary. And in response to this, the film festival tried to say that they're taking a neutral stance, which, in my opinion, was them trying to distance themselves from their original decision. And then they finally decided to remove the film from the festival, which I thought was fantastic. And at this point, the anti-vax and Wakefield supporters claimed that Wakefield was being censored. And this is really the big exclamation point on this whole story, is that, the idea that Wakefield is being censored is ridiculous. It's childish, if anything. This is clearly not censorship. The Tribeca Film Festival is a private company. They don't have any responsibility to allow all and any ideas to be represented in their festival. If anything, I'd say that the festival organizers have a tremendous responsibility to make sure that the documentary films are based in reality and are of high quality. And, that's a perfectly fine reason to either not invite someone or uninvite someone because they found out that there was something significantly wrong with their film and that they don't want to expose that to a lot of people and continue to spread these ridiculous ideas. The larger the brand, you're like a company like Coca-Cola who has a global presence, I would say has a massive responsibility to make sure that they're not spreading pseudoscience and misdirecting people. And I would say that the Tribeca Film Festival has a similar responsibility.
Yeah, unfortunately, the damage is already done in that they've now given a lot of attention to this crappy documentary. And just, you know, to go into a little bit more detail, it's not just that we disagree with what the documentary says. Its quality is horrible. ORAC wrote a good series of posts on Respectful Insolence. If you want to go into detail, just look, you know, on his blog and you could read as much detail as you want. But here's the very quick skinny, is that this is basically detailing the story of William Thompson, who is the alleged, you know, the quote-unquote CDC whistleblower. He basically is the guy who was working at the CDC who had a disagreement with his colleagues about how to deal with an issue with data. And he discussed it with Brian Hooker, who's an anti-vaccinationist. And Hooker essentially took it all out of context. Now, I disagree with Thompson. I think he's totally speaking out of turn and he's being a jerk. But Brian Hooker did things like in this documentary now, in the Vax documentary, taking bits of conversation that he recorded out of literally out of sequence and out of context to create an impression that is not true.
That is reprehensible and it should be illegal. Come on. You're manufacturing lies, putting lies in someone's mouth.
And then Hooker's also the guy. So this, the other thing is they're trying to say that this data supports the, a connection between the MMR vaccine, mumps, measles, and rubella, and autism. First of all, even in their own reanalysis of the data, it only showed a link with African-American boys.
Which is a red flag right there.
It's a red flag right there. It's only in a subgroup. So you're also saying that simultaneously that there is no association with any other group? I mean, before it was like a major cause of autism. Now it's only in this one subgroup. And that's not even true. I mean, that's – so essentially the CDC – you know, had to do, they did fairly standard, totally transparent and above board statistical analysis in order to make sense of these numbers. And Hooker is basically saying, no, you can't do any kind of statistical analysis. You have to just look at the raw numbers, which is nonsense. There's no such thing as raw numbers when you're talking about epidemiological data like this. So you always got to make adjustments for how the data was collected, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Hooker is the one, you know, is reanalyzing the data, saying that there's this connection with African American boys. It's been utterly deconstructed and shown to be completely horrible science. It's nonsense. Andrew Wakefield is backing this up now because it's quote unquote vindicating him, right? Because it's showing a connection, even though it isn't really. And that's essentially what the whole film is based on, their crappy reanalysis of this data and then trying to, you know, misinterpret Thompson's, you know, disagreements into like a cover up of this connection between MMR and autism. And from the trailer and from Wakefield's YouTube videos that he's released basically over the same material, you know, the documentary style is all this, you know, ominous music and slow motion, and it's all the usual things that they do to make it seem like there's this big, you know, deep dark cover up. It's just total crap. It has no place in the Tribeca Film Festival. Just basic level of quality control is enough to keep it out. There's no censorship here. You know, it, that the crying censorship, I said, the only thing that does is make you look like a whiny idiot. But that's what they do, right? Because what's the, you know, if people cry censorship because they don't want to admit the reality, which is their, whatever they're doing is crap. You know, so if they can't admit that to themselves, that's where else do they have to go? Saying, oh, there's a conspiracy against me. We're being silenced. No, you just, your work is crap. That's why you don't belong in whatever venue won't have you.
And I wonder, you know, how much they benefited from actually having the controversy take place.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
You know, on a subject like this, any press is good press for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's better that it's not going to be at the festival. They won't be able to claim that. But
they brought attention to it.
Yeah, they still got the attention, which is unfortunate. All right. Bob, tell us about Craig Venter's latest milestone.
Yeah, J. Craig Venter is at it again. He and his team at Synthetic Genomics have created a synthetic organism with a viable genome smaller than anything that evolved the old retro Evo way. Pretty amazing. Venter, if his name sounds only vaguely familiar, he's best known for being the lead guy of the private sector's efforts to sequence the human genome for the first time. Remember, geez, was that more than 15 years ago now? He also created the first synthetic life of sorts back in 2010. You may remember, I believe we must have talked about it. But so that work in 2010 was important. Essentially, what they did was synthetically recreate the genome of a bacterium called the Mycoplasma mycoides from four bottles of chemicals. They then transplanted that synthetic genome into another bacterium, Mycoplasma capricolum. And then the new bacterial genome then took over the cell and started to thrive and reproduce. And they called that SYN 1.0. That's S-Y-N for synthetic, obviously. So that step, though, even though it was an important achievement and it had never been done before, it was really just a proof of concept to see that this kind of stuff could be done. Their ultimate goal was to create a living organism with the most minimal set of genes possible, allowing it to sustain itself and reproduce the most basic components of life, if you will. All else is arguably just window dressing, apparently. So to that end, they started with SYN 1.0, and they started removing genes based on what we thought were superfluous. So they created two whole genomes, inserted them into another bacterium or bacteria, and then those attempts failed. It did not live. So they went to their next strategy, which was to split the genome into eight discrete segments, and then they remove genes, and they would see which resulting cells survived when they put it all together. And if it died, then they clearly took something out that was critical. So eventually they created SYN 2.0, which lived and thrived and had the smallest genome of any natural cell. Now they've created SYN 3.0, and that has even fewer genes. So to put it into perspective, say a typical bacteria, say, has 4,000 to 5,000 genes, which control and do everything that bacteria do in their daily tasks day to day. Then you've got the parasitic Mycoplasma genitalium. I'll say that again, Mycoplasma genitalium. I don't know why they call it that.
What's with that, Bob?
But I want to check that out. Maybe there's some bacteria porn sites out there. That has the smallest genome we've ever found, 525 genes. SYN 3.0 has just 473 genes. Ew. So it's a good chunk below that. But that's not even the coolest thing. So if you look at this SYN 3.0, you look at all the genes. You've got a whole bunch that deal with the preservation of genomic information. You know, the replication, repair, metabolism, cell division. Then you've got a bunch of genes that deal with the cell membrane structure and the function, controlling the composition of the cytoplasm, okay? Then you've got 31% of the genes. That's 149 genes out of the 473. We don't know what the hell they are. We know very little or nothing at all about what a third of those genes do. Now, many of them are highly conserved, which means that they're found in many, many other organisms, which suggests, of course, that they're quite important. But it's just an amazing, you know, suite of genes that they found that are most likely critical for life. At the worst, you know, maybe 80% of them are critical for life, and we just don't know anything about them. So it's just a huge, potential font of discovery. So that was one of the main things that came out of this. Another interesting finding that I found pretty intriguing has to do with complexity. Now, Venter's team, they actually reorganized the cell DNA. They made it simpler. They made it modular. They made it organized when they put it all together. So much so that Christopher Voigt, who's a professor of biological engineering at MIT, he said, if human designers can create an ordered, structured alternative to how life is found in nature, that would speak to the complexity of biology simply being an artifact of how it was shaped by evolution. So as complicated as biology is, it doesn't necessarily need to stay that way in terms of the synthetic life that we create and still essentially be, you know, complicated, interesting organisms. So that's the crux of what he's done now. So for the future, clearly there's really good targets, you know, specific targets for future research. And of course, I'm referring to those genes that we just don't even know what they're doing. So we can learn a lot more about the very, very essential minimum building blocks of life. And they could also come up with new applications like engineering cells with these new metabolic pathways. And they could do things like break down contaminants and who knows what else they can do.
Yeah, Venter was saying that the stripped down bacterium is like a frame. And then you can plug in modules that have specific functions. And
sure.
Yeah, so to really speed up the rate at which you can customize genetically modified bacteria for making drugs, producing biofuel, cleaning up, you know, plastic or toxic waste spills, or just,
right,
you know, producing precursors for chemical, you know,
sure,
engineering. Yeah.
But right, and the first step to really do that is to have this little tiny unit of life. And also, it's important to point out that they had a good quote here that Venter said that there's no such thing as a true minimal genome without context. And that's an interesting concept, because this cell that they created, they had to make certain tweaks that you wouldn't find in nature. So, for example, its food source was incredibly regular, something that you wouldn't find in nature. So that actually affected the genes that they used. Also, the laboratory space that they developed it in was very regulated in terms of temperature. So this genome did not need anything that would help with temperature regulation. And sure, those are important things if you're out in the environment, but it just really drives home the fact that a minimal genome doesn't mean much unless you specify what the context is. And I just thought that was an interesting aside.
I like that. Yeah,
there were also semi-optional genes. So essentially, they found the minimal genes really fell into three categories. There were genes that the single gene was essential to be alive at all, to live and reproduce. Then
right.
There were genes that were essential but redundant. So like there might be two genes and you need one of the two, but you don't need both. And then there was a third one that they called semi-optional, where the cell was able to live and reproduce, but slowly. And if it wanted to exist robustly, you know, robust thrive and reproduce, it needed the gene. And of course, he kept those in, because if you want a bacterium that will be useful for industrial purposes, yeah, then you want it to be robust, not just limping along and barely surviving. Now, of course, we know what's going to happen next, right? Is that the intelligent design crowd is going to say, irreducible complexity. A cell needs these, you know, 400 and whatever genes. So how could you ever get to a single living cell prior to having all of these genes? And you know, they're already saying that, but
sure,
of course, that's in, as you already alluded to, Bob, context is everything.
Sure.
But also, yeah, once you develop the interdependency, then sure, you ratchet up the minimal number of genes you need. But that's evolved interdependency. It doesn't mean that there are no possible antecedents. And again, also, as I said, a lot of these genes are necessary for the cell to thrive.
And reproduce.
But, yeah.
And reproduce. Yeah. That's like part of our definition of what it means to be alive. But early building blocks didn't necessarily have to do that.
Well, they did have to reproduce, but they didn't have to thrive. They could have limped along. They might have been able to
be
barely alive, and they might have had a very slow reproduction cycle. It doesn't matter. As long as they were able to be alive and reproduce at all, they would be able to evolve. And
you have billions of years. And before that, even minimal state, Steve, okay, it's not life. It's chemistry, you know?
I meant. Like, they're the building blocks. The building blocks don't necessarily have to reproduce the same way that we think of life. They just have to be able to combine.
Yeah, yeah.
And combine over and over until we have consistency.
Right. Well, Evan, you're going to tell us about the last news item this week, something about vegetarians and cancer.
Well, this headline certainly stuck out like a sore thumb today, I think. Headline read, long-term vegetarian diet changes human DNA, raising risk of cancer and heart disease. Well, my first thought was, diets can change human DNA? There probably is something wrong there. So I obviously had to read a little further as my curiosity was piqued. Well, here's what they wrote. Long-term vegetarianism can lead to genetic mutations which raise the risk of heart disease and cancer, scientists have found. Not so sure that really genetic mutations lead to anything specifically. So that's an interesting way that they put it there.
Yeah. I sense that the key word is long time. And
yeah.
What like do very, they mean by that exactly?
Like a very long time. So, well, I mean, effectively what they did is they took a look at this this study. The work came from the Molecular Biology and Evolution, at least that's where it was published, where the researchers had compared these different populations, one vegetarian population from India and another population, meat eaters in the United States.
Sounds complicated. If very only we had an expert who could help us sort our way through this complicated technical study outside of our area of expertise.
I know. Botany and DNA. Who could we possibly call on? Who knows?
It's too last minute. You're
what about
dreaming.
What about that Folta guy?
The strawberry guy?
Yeah. Strawberry man?
I know him.
No, I don't like him very much. Get somebody else.
He helps make the world taste good. I admit.
You realize this is like... It's like rubbing the genie lamp.
Is that you, Kevin?
Yes, that's me.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide. Thanks for helping us out with this particular news item.
Well, I understand that there's some pseudoscience that needs to be resolved.
Yeah. Actually, so you put on your cape and
we picked up the phone, the red phone, and called.
Well, actually, it actually caught my eyeball too, because it said being one of the articles out there said being a vegetarian could kill you. Science warns.
Oh, is that what it is?
And well, as a guy who was a vegetarian for 17 years and still doesn't like eating meat that much, I'm kind of nervous. And your synopsis was very good. That really what it showed is there are changes in DNA that happen when people eat all vegetable diets. However, this isn't talking about a person eating an all vegetable diet. This is talking about in populations. And what they were examining, this group was looking at association studies, which means they're looking at changes that occur in DNA within populations and associating them with specific either dietary trends, diseases, or metabolic trends. So in other words, let me put that in English. When they looked at groups in India who for thousands of years have only eaten vegetarian diets, they found that some of the genes associated with fatty acid synthesis or fatty acid conversion were different than those that were found in Westerners. So fatty acids are extremely important to human health. And we use them for nutrients that have to do with energy storage, cellular repair, growth, all kinds of neurological functions. And so the body requires fatty acids, and we can produce some of it. However, most of it's taken in the diet. And so when we eat animals, the animals have already done that job for us. They've eaten plants and converted fatty acids into forms that can be readily taken up and used by humans. So vegetarians have a little challenge here because they don't have the animals to do that kind of preconditioning of these fatty acids. So vegetarians have to do that on site. What they found is that there are long-term vegetarian populations that have changes to the enzymes, especially this enzyme called fatty acid desaturase, that make it more efficient. So if you're only eating vegetables, this population has an enzyme that allows for that conversion to happen better. And all it really tells us is that fatty acids are important, and that it over a million years, they suggest this mutation goes back a million years, that those populations in India that had this mutation were more successful at living and reproducing. In addition, it was interesting because they showed Inuits. They had folks up in Greenland who actually had the same gene with a deletion in it, but it actually made them less efficient at producing fatty acids that were required for the diet, because their diet was already very high in fatty acids from fish and blubber animals. The reason that all this ties in with issues like colorectal cancer and coronary artery disease, is because in India, or like these populations that already have this very efficient enzyme that has been selected by time, is that now that we live in a world where these fatty acids are prevalent in vegetable products, so linoleic acid and many of the fatty acid precursors that are present, or fatty acids that are present in our oils, now that you're eating a lot of that stuff, now your improved enzyme plus a lot coming in the beginning means you kind of overdose on a good thing. And it leads to issues with inflammation and other breakdowns in homeostasis in the body. So it's having a very efficient enzyme coupled to a large dietary intake is leading to a problem in the overall health of those individuals.
Yeah, so they're adapted to a pre-industrial diet, you know, in terms of the mix of fatty acids. And now they're getting all the fatty acids that they need in the diet, plus they have this gene that makes even more, and they don't really need it anymore. So their ratio of fatty acids is being thrown off, and that's leading to a more unhealthy balance rather than, you know, a more optimal balance.
And that's exactly it. Yeah. It's that time forced them to make their hardware better. And now they have the good hardware in a place where they don't need it. And now their inputs are resulting in all of the inputs are rich in these fatty acids. Plus they're very efficient at making more of it.
Yeah.
So it's leading to these problems of inflammation that could eventually lead to these other diseases.
So would they be better off if they switched to eating more meat, or do they have to just switch away from modern vegetable oils?
Well, this is a really nice example of how by understanding our genomics and our individual DNA fingerprints, how that can actually have clinical manifestations. I think if I was somebody who was presenting two alleles for this particular gene, which has a really catchy name. I can't remember the number they have on this, but if you had both alleles for this particular gene, it may be advisable to really watch your intake of fatty acids from non-animal sources and to be thinking about ways to actually curtail those particular inputs in your diet.
Yeah, but although I think from what I read, fish and nuts are okay. It's really the vegetable oils that are the problem.
Right. That's the problem. It's because of a balance of omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids that change the flux through the pathway to what's called arachidonic acid. That's the stuff you get from meat. And so if you can actually just keep that flux in order and eat the right foods, it could make a difference. The problem are these high linoleic oils and oils that are rich in the early fatty acids into the pathway that can skew the total output with people with this high producing gene.
So it really has nothing to do with individual like Americans being taking on a vegetarian lifestyle. There's no issue there.
Well, that allele is present in North American populations. It's present in something like 17% of populations, meaning or of the population, meaning it's present, but not necessarily in its homozygous form, meaning you got a copy from mom and a copy from dad.
Yeah.
It's a little bit rare in our population. Other parts of the world, it's extremely prevalent. And the paper breaks it down and shows that folks of European descent tend to have they don't have this efficiency allele. So it has nothing to do with you being a vegetarian or making those types of food choices, changing your DNA. It just says that at one time, there were people that benefited from having a more efficient way of processing vegetables.
So it all depends on your ancestry. I mean, is this a case being made for having your genome sequenced? I mean, is that the kind of information you would get from a commercial genetic analysis?
I don't know that that is part of their plan yet, because this is a relatively new allele, but there's a relatively new gene variant. But it's something that I think within a couple years would be the case. The literature already shows that there are a number of alleles in these genes that are associated with coronary artery disease, type 2 diabetes. But mostly when you look at the difference between African Americans and European descent Americans, you see that there are a variety of what they call SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, mm-hmm. basically differences in the A's, G's, C's, and T's of DNA, that those SNPs do associate, meaning they correlate with disease, and they haven't yet shown the causality. Like, why would that change the enzyme in a way that would affect the way that we process these important important molecules? This paper that came out today shows a mechanism. It shows it changes the way in which the flux potentially would move through that pathway, which could underlie further disease manifestations for those discrete populations.
They need a flux capacitor.
Yeah, I read my mind.
That'll do it. Patch that right up.
It solves everything.
Yeah, it'll solve everything. Yeah.
Well, Kevin, you just said what I could not say, so I really appreciate you doing that for our audience.
So, Kevin, I understand you've been battling pseudoscience in other venues as well. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a really interesting story. We've had a problem with what I've been referring to as pseudoscience creep. At our national conferences, at our museums, at other reputable places of science, we're finding more and more people kind of sneaking in under the radar to push an agenda, kind of borrowing the credibility of the venue. And we've seen this more and more. There were talks at the plant animal genome meeting this year that were highly suspect. there were a lot of this is going on. The Vaxxed movie at Tribeca.
Yeah, we just talked about that.
Yeah, even though that's not necessarily a scientifically credible place, it was good that they pulled it. Well, at the Houston Museum of Natural Science, they had a guy named Terry Verain, who is used to be in molecular biology in Canada, and he's been long looked at as very curious with respect to his claims towards genetic engineering and associated technologies. And a couple of groups had him booked at the Houston Museum of Natural Science. And this was really alarming because the Houston Museum of Natural Science is a beautiful museum. And when you look at their website and all the good things they do, here's kind of a very off the radar talk called The Poison in Your Food. And the abstract was all about how when you eat genetically engineered food, how it causes all these problems, how glyphosate, the chemical used to control weeds, is linked to all of this disease. And the literature does not support those interpretations. So I wrote an article on pseudoscience creep on my blog, and that got picked up quickly by Twitter and other places. And soon the museum was just getting bombarded with how could you invite this person who isn't speaking from science and loaning them the credibility of your scientific institute. Sure. Mm-hmm. And the museum was wonderful. They contacted me and asked, well, what is wrong with these claims? What are the what's the facts? You know, and I talked to them about the pharmacology and the kinetics of glyphosate metabolism and the residual amounts that are actually detected on food and the biological thresholds. And they contacted the speaker and asked him to produce any kind of peer-reviewed literature with respect to his claims, and he couldn't do it. Ooh. So they canceled the event the day it was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome. The day of. Wow.
Yeah, which was really very
brave,
gutsy for them.
Yep.
But they saw what was happening. Here was a person with very little scientific information that was really stealing their credibility and using that to promote a non-scientific message.
Yeah, I think there is still a naivete among academics that – you know, people aren't going to try to cheat them, you know, and that if somebody is presenting themselves as legitimate, well, they can't be a pseudoscientist, right? I mean, that wouldn't be right. You know, it's just naivete. They're not aware of the fact that, yeah, there are charlatans out there who will pretend to be legitimate and try to sneak one by the goalpost. And it's our job to keep that from happening. And I'm just, you know, we have to make sure that the scientific community takes that job more seriously, because that just happens all too often, unfortunately.
Well, this was a beautiful case of that. And one of the things that was alarming was people who were with the museum, maybe in non-scientific capacities, but maybe in PR capacities, saying we really need to have all sides of an argument discussed here. This is important. And I had to go back to, we don't do teach the controversy here, that all sides are welcome. If we want to debate science, if we want to debate interpretations of evidence, that's great. That's really healthy. But just because somebody has a crazy idea or makes claims based upon very suspect published science doesn't mean that we should entertain it. The reason is that people go to this kind of event because they're curious. You know, they've been freaked out by everybody. They're really even maybe nervous about their food and what they're feeding their family. And this is just a person who is giving them poor information, but doing it under the banner of a very reputable museum.
Yeah. The place to have a debate is in the published literature, is in the peer-reviewed literature. If you want to have your ideas heard, you need to have them heard there first. And only then, once you've established the legitimacy of your claim, should it be filtering down to textbooks and museums and science documentaries and whatever. As you say, yeah, the teach the controversy is also like the, oh, we're going to, it's the false balance. We're going to do both sides. Yep. Yeah. And it misinforms the public, about what is legitimate science and what's established science. All right, Kevin. Well, thanks so much for being on Speed Dial.
Anytime.
Or the bat phone, whatever you want to use.
I work best on a few minutes' notice. So thank you so much for the opportunity. This is the best. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Take care, man. See you, man.
So, guys, we got an email recently from podcastawards.com. We've won the podcast award in the education and science categories for several years running. I think we got it four or five times total. So the email basically said that we've won so much that we're no longer going to be in the running.
Because I hate when that happens.
They were getting complaints that the same podcast were winning every year, so they decided, and this is reasonable, and I've been involved in other situations where they did this. Like if you win three times, then you get into like the Hall of Fame sort of thing. So like you're permanent, you've won permanently, you know, so that you're not, you don't just keep, the same people don't keep winning every year. So that's the case. So we eventually, we've become a legacy podcast for the podcast awards. We've won so much. We're just sort of in the legacy. Yeah, in a way, it's nice.
No pressure.
Yeah, takes the pressure. Takes the pressure off.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I totally get it. It makes sense, and I feel, you know, kind of honored that you know, they contacted us and said, "Hey, we want to just say, all right, you've won so much that, you know, come on, guys, you got the message, okay?" But if you listen to the show, if you appreciate the SGU and the work that we do here, you know, going on 11 years and 560 episodes, Steve.
That's this one, 560.
Ooh. 560. You could become an SGU member and you could join us. You can contribute to the SGU. You will gain access to at the $8 a month level, you'll gain access to our premium content. We have a ton of premium content. We add stuff all the time.
And just the most recent thing I added was the audio from our Star Wars review. A lot of people are asking me, when's the Star Wars review going up? Well, the video processing, you know, post-production was taking so long, I decided to put the audio up, but it's premium content. So it's only for our premium members. They get the audio early and then the video goes up whenever we get that. I don't know when that's going to happen. But we do, as often as I can, as often I have time to do extra processing, we put up premium content. I have a lot of stuff in the can to put up there.
And you can also, you know, Nexus is coming up. That's our conference in New York City in May, starting on May 15th. And you will get a discount to register for that as well.
Yep, just email me for the discount code and I'll give that to you. And, you know, it is a great way to support the SGU. We are still involved in a very expensive lawsuit. Very expensive. And the best way, we had our legal defense fund for a while, but now we shut that down. And now, if you want to support us, just become a member. That's the best way to support the SGU.
Please help us to help the world. We love doing this show, and we love each other, and we love you. So contribute.
I was a little sappy there, Jay, but that's okay. All right, Jay, who's that noisy up to date?
All right, so last week I played an amazing noisy. Here it is. Right? It's awesome.
It's so awesome now that I know what the hell that is.
Yeah. That noisy was sent in by a listener named Chucky Lynch.
That guy on the platform at the subway I saw that day. didn't want to make eye contact with him.
I'm utterly blown away that I researched this and it's legitimate. Okay, so I'll start by saying that. So, guys, any guesses on this?
Oh, boy.
Sounds like a walrus.
What? Like John Lennon?
That indeed was Hoover the Harbor Seal.
A Harbor Seal. No. That's close. Yeah, close.
Steve, you were so far off.
He was an orphaned seal and found by George and Alice Swallow in Maine in 1971. They took him home, put him in the bathtub. Then he got a little bit bigger. They put him in like a pond in the front. Then he got a little bit bigger. And while in the pond, he started to imitate people that walked by and people's voices and stuff. And they later moved him to the New England Aquarium in the United States. And the seal would say things like, "Get out of here," and "Well, hello there," in thick New England accent.
Oh, my gosh.
No.
Epic, yes.
I wonder if he packed the cat in the yard.
This week's noisy was correctly guessed first by Cassie Edgerton. Good job, Cassie. A lot of people wrote in. I got a couple of funny things that people wrote in. This one guy said, "To who's that noisy? It's two friendly pirates saying hello on the boardwalk. Yar." And then favorite one, follow me on this. That is definitely Christopher Lloyd's impression of an elephant seal.
Oh, God.
I love it. Yep.
It's actually the other way around.
Yeah, that's right.
I know, right? So I have a new noisy for you this week, and I will play that right now. So please do send me in any noisies that you guys have. It's really, really hard to find new and interesting things, so I'm getting a lot of help from listeners. Please send your guesses. Please send your noisies to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, Kara, what's the word?
What's the word this week? The word is chemiosmosis. Woo! You guys excited about that word?
That's an exciting word, Kara.
It's very. A really exciting word.
I'm very excited.
It's an amalgamation of two words, right? Osmosis and chemi, as in chemical. It was actually first kind of utilized and first coined by Peter Mitchell, Nobel Prize winning Peter Mitchell, in the 60s when he first started talking about this hypothetical model for how ATP was produced in cells. And if you don't know, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, is kind of what we think about as the cellular currency, our energy source that we utilize. And it's actually produced by phosphorylating ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And that happens in these little cellular machines inside of the mitochondria or the chloroplast in eukaryotes, so more complex organisms, and in simpler organisms, prokaryotes, bacteria, it occurs freely in the cytoplasm. And ATP is formed by making this proton gradient, actually, across a membrane. So if you look at a mitochondrion or a chloroplast under a scanning electron microscopy, you'll see that it is a whole bunch of membrane. It's like wiggle, 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 wiggle. And across that membrane, what actually happens is that there's a pump and these protons are pushed across the membrane the same way that osmosis happens, going from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. And that movement is actually what phosphorylates that ADP to produce ATP. And it's really important. It's one of these things that sounds complicated. It is complicated. You learn about it in intro biology. But once you grasp it, you get it. And it's really important because without it, life wouldn't exist because we need energy.
It's kind of
and
an important cells, fundamental. Yeah,
it's a fundamental thing.
Even just the mere phenomenon of chemicals passively diffusing down their
across
gradient,
a membrane.
That's like the one of the fundamental basis of neurology, right? That's how your nerves work. Yeah, that's how all of your cells maintain. They also have pumps. They have proteins that pump things against the gradient, but also the osmosis is a critical part of that as well. It's how cells maintain, their environment. All right. Well, everyone, let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I have secured three science news items from my super secret source that I will never reveal.
The New York Times.
And the New York Times, right? Here they are.
New York Times.
Item number one. Scientists have developed transparent wood that can be used as building material. Item number two. A new computer model indicates that some heavy elements, such as gold, may have been formed near the event horizon of hungry black holes.
I love gold.
Item number three. New research finds that a new technique for scrolling information on a computer screen improves skimming efficiency by 60% and allows readers to find points of interest 210% faster.
There are too many numbers in that one.
You did it again.
Oh, I talked first again! Oh, no impulse control. None whatsoever.
Your mute button is
you
your
would be
friend.
Great. You would be great at Simon Says. But I'm going to have Jay go first this time.
Scientists have developed transparent wood.
Build a bridge out of it.
That can be used as building materials. Transparent aluminum. So we start with wood, then we move to aluminum. Is that the plan, Steve?
No, this is just transparent wood.
Yeah.
Got it. But are they going to hold whales inside of a cage made out of transparent wood?
Maybe.
Anybody? Okay, so
I got you.
All right, transparent wood. Fine. A new computer model indicates that some heavy elements, such as gold, may have been formed near the event horizon of hungry black holes. Damn. I don't know about that. Extraordinary pressure required, check. Lots of material, check. But then what? The black hole has to evaporate, and that's how the gold would get out. But they didn't say the gold got out. This is all plausible. Let me move on to the third one. New research finds that a new technique for scrolling information on a computer screen improves skimming efficiency by 60% and allows readers to find points of interest 210% faster. No. A new way to scroll. I don't believe in new ways of scrolling. This one's the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Wow. I mean, I could, for the transparent wood, I mean, I could think small samples possibly, but I mean, would it even be wood anymore if it's really transparent like that? The gold one, I'm just not understanding how that would work. I mean, I could see a collision of black holes possibly, even then. Let's see, the scrolling one. Yeah, I mean, sure. That's not bothering me nearly as much as those first two. All right, I'm gonna go with the black holes. I just can't think of a mechanism.
Okay, Kara.
Huh. I think that transparent wood might be possible. I've seen some wood that's very thin that you could almost see through. I don't know.
She giggles at the end like, buy that.
I don't know. I'm struggling with whether I GWB or GWJ. I'm kind of feeling to GWJ because I don't like the scrolling thing either. I don't like it. I feel like every time I read a study about a new way for hyperlinks on a page, it always screws you. Like, it never helps you. It's always like the more bells and whistles we add to text on a screen, the like worse our reading comprehension gets. So I think I'm going to say that the transparent wood is science, that gold at the event horizon is science, and that this new scrolling technique is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Excellent.
Well, I think the transparent wood one is going to turn out to be correct. It's the other two that I'm concentrating on here. So, heavy elements such as gold. Well, we were all taught that these heavy elements happen at the heart of stars, not at the edges of black holes. It seems like it's the polar opposite. I wonder what the hell is happening there. Scrolling information on a computer screen, skimming efficiency by 60%. And allows readers to find points of interest 210% faster. Those numbers, yeah, I guess the skimming efficiency is 60%. Something's amiss here. These numbers, I don't like that 210% faster either. Like, where the hell did they pull that from, and how do they really measure that? I think it's too hard to maybe measure, so that's probably where I'm not clicking on that one. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Bob, they're leaving you hanging out to dry there.
I'm not worried.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging out to dry. You're not worried? Do you think that you're more confident in your choice than the other three, huh?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's take the one. We'll start with the one you all agree on. Scientists have developed transparent wood that can be used as building material. You all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Okay.
Transparent wood.
Thick enough for building material, huh?
That's what they say. So
The Swedes made it. I read this one.
They did two things to the wood to make it transparent. The first thing they did was remove the lignin. Lignin is the component that absorbs most of the light. 80 to 95% of the light is absorbed by the lignin.
Really?
Yep.
Hmm. Yeah, but what else does the lignin do, though?
Yeah.
It doesn't contribute to structural integrity or strength or any of that?
Well, it's described as a structural polymer, so I would assume that it does.
Okay.
So, but the resulting material, after removing the lignin, still scattered the light too much to really be transparent. So they incorporated into it acrylic, which is basically plexiglass. It's not entirely wood anymore, but it is, they're still saying it's wood, but it has plexiglass in it instead of the lignin. And then you get something that is pretty transparent. And they said it's something, it's actually stronger than regular wood. It's twice as strong as plexiglass. It's still not crystal clear. It's a little bit hazy, which makes sense. But imagine, though, building a ceiling or a roof or
lighting,
a wall out of this wood, it would be transparent. Light would get through. It'd be an interesting way to light a room, during the day. They also said this part seems like pure speculation, that it may be useful in improving the efficiency of solar cells because it traps some of the light. What? It could boost solar cells. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what they're talking about there. But. Okay, let's move on. Number two, a new computer model indicates that some heavy elements such as gold may have been formed near the event horizon of hungry black holes. Bob is alone in thinking that this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Damn. Oh, I should have.
Suck it, Bob.
I trust my basic instincts.
There was a computer model.
Computer.
And it did deal with the ultimate source of gold and other heavy elements. Now, as I'm sure we've talked about on the show before, you know, the stars burn, you know, elements into heavier elements. They through fusion, that's their energy. First hydrogen to helium, but then into heavier and heavier elements, all the way up to
lead.
Iron.
That's right. Iron.
Yeah, iron.
I always confuse those two.
You can't get energy out of iron by fizzing or fusing it, so that's the bottom of the
energy.
It takes more energy put into it than you
would get out.
And that's only for the biggest stars can get up to iron.
Right.
But everything heavier than iron needs to be made somewhere else and in a more energetic process than the core of a star. So there are two possible sources of heavier elements. One is during catastrophic supernova.
So what happens there is that you have the collapse of the inner core of the star, and that collapse is just so energetic. It's quickly and temporarily has pressures and temperatures far above what the core used to be. And that's where you have the whole suite of heavier elements that are created and then spewed out when it rebounds back.
Right. And what's the other one, Bob?
Well, the only thing I could think – yeah, definitely not a black hole because there's nothing really happening there to create the temperatures and pressures. The only thing I could think of is like colliding neutron stars white dwarfs. Yeah, it would have to be something that would be analogous to the supernova. Neutron stars
merger, they also can explode and spew out huge amounts of stellar debris, including heavier elements. Or at least that's the theory, right? So yeah. The physicists created a computer model that will help them try to figure out which one of the two, or maybe both, is the answer. Like, where is most of the gold in the universe coming from? Is it coming from supernova? Is it coming from neutron star mergers? I made up the black hole bit. But I thought it sounded semi-plausible. Because if you have...
It did.
Yeah, if you have, like, the swirling disk of material that a hungry black hole is eating, and that material does get pretty hot and dense and it is throwing, you know, X-rays and everything out. Maybe you could think maybe it's throwing out some debris, some heavy.
Oh, you're
maybe
so
it's even
silly.
Possible.
But I'd say an accretion disk. Yeah, an accretion disk can be bright as hell, especially in X-rays. But man, I would bet never it's going to be as intense as required for the heavy elements. But I could be surprised, but I severely doubt it. But nice.
Anyway, I made it up. It sounded semi-plausible, but I agree. I don't think that's going to turn out to be the case either, but maybe some of the bigger black holes with like really massive accretion disks, who knows?
So you lied to us.
I lied. flat out.
He always lies every week.
I do it all the time. I can't help it.
Compulsive.
All right. Item number three. New research finds that a new technique for scrolling information on a computer screen improves skimming efficiency by 60% and allows readers to find points of interest 210% faster. Is science just changing the way information scrolls up and down the computer
screen? That's impressive.
Screen?
So how do they do it?
Yeah.
What do we do?
So first they say that the typical scrolling is really inefficient because, first of all, everything scrolls. And so your eye is distracted by all of the information going up and down the screen, including
the ads and images,
stuff that you're not interested in. So I'm not entirely sure because it's not even in beta. They just have like a prototype. So I wasn't able to see it in action. I just have their written description of what's happening. So I'll read it for you and you tell me what you think is happening. The software is called Spotlight. And they said it's based upon research on visual attention about how long it takes to focus your attention on something, and the fact of, and also on minimizing distractions. So this is their description of it. This is from Dr. Lee, one of the people who developed it. The new technique locates on each web page, whether it is a PDF document, video, or web document, the visually important elements and presents them using a transparent layer that appears on top of the text. That might be that appears on top of the text. The elements can be, for example, pictures, tables, or headlines. It chooses what you should focus on and allows you enough time to do that. Our empirical evaluation showed that benefits are significant. In this way, people can scroll through as many as 20 pages per second and still retain information.
What?
This is skimming. This is skimming. This is not reading.
You're
looking for information. The technique improves recollection of browsed information. So anyway, that's what they're claiming. They did an empirical analysis, and we'll see if it, you know, again, I haven't seen anything in actual use. They said the browsing of long texts speeds up by 60% and less than half as much time is spent locating the desired locations in the text. In addition, the probability of noticing points of interest in the text is increased by 210% compared to normal scrolling technique. So, yeah, pretty interesting. I could see how if you're just scrolling the stuff that you're interested in and everything else is sort of static and out of the way, that could be helpful.
Yeah.
And it really is not designed, it's not optimized for attention. You know what I mean? There's no real effort was made to optimize scrolling for the way our brains process information. So I could see how just looking at how we process visual information and making an attempt to optimize it for that could get some significant increase. That seems plausible.
Gosh, someday scrolling will be looked at as like some archaic form of gathering information or viewing information. It's like, I had to scroll
like
when I was a
catalog.
Kid. Granddad, you're so out of it.
It's like what we had the conversation about film and how films are so much more fast paced, and that it's interesting because it's a Craig was telling us it's a give and take. It's the viewers learning the film techniques, and then the film techniques evolving to the users, and this give and take. And it could be the same thing. It's like when we use software, the programmers and the users are co-evolving to learn the same visual language and this sort of what's standard, right? Things become standard. So you expect them to behave a certain way, and then that standard iterates and evolves to become more and more efficient, at least it's supposed to, you know. It's why it's so frustrating when you're trying to deal with a piece of software that has a horrible user interface, you know, because we're getting used to all of the standard conventions because they exist for a reason, because they make it easier for your eye to find the information it's looking for. And when you don't adhere to even the basics of a user interface, it really is annoying.
Well, that's how I feel when I use a PC.
Yeah, that's part of the Mac PC divide. Part of it is just you develop certain instincts that, you know, and it's hard to retrain yourself.
Yeah, it's like anytime you get a brand new phone, if you go from a Galaxy to an iPhone, or, you know, you really change things completely, it's super confusing and you're like, everything is wrong. But it's not wrong, it's just different.
Yeah, it's just different. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right, well, good job, Bob.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob, good job.
Gosh, why didn't I go with whatever? Damn it.
Anyway, so Evan, do you have a quote?
Well, yes, Jay, in fact, I do. Steve, you mentioned Craig earlier in the science fiction segment. That is, of course, Craig Good, listener of the SGU, an occasional contributor. He sent us this week's quote to use, which I really like, and here it is. Science is not the opposite of art or expression. Science has no motives or end goal other than to inform. You can act on that information in whatever way you choose. And that was said by, I've not heard of this person before, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, also known as Kenji, American chef and food writer. He's the managing culinary director of Serious Eats, which is a popular food blog, and he's author of the James Beard Award-nominated column The Food Lab. So he unravels the science of home cooking, which I think is great and fascinating. I know other chefs do that as part of their expression, and the way they communicate science to people is through cooking exercises. And you can learn a lot about science through people like Kenji, Alton Brown, and some others. So,
cooking is chemistry. Yeah, absolutely.
It is. It's great, very practical way to learn it. And I think what he said there in that quote is exactly right.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, thank you, Evan, and thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.